Today's episode is about a case that happened in Canada in 2008. It is the story of a 24-year-old realtor who died tragically in the course of her employment. This crime shocked the city of Victoria, British Columbia. It is still a controversial case, as despite having numerous leads and circumstantial evidence, the police were never able to identify her assailant. It is a complicated case, and I ask that you pay close attention to try to understand the facts surrounding Lindsay Buziak's death. Lindsay Elizabeth Buziak was born on November 2nd, 1983, in Victoria, Canada, the daughter of Jeff and Evelyn Buziak. She was part of a big family, had many friends, and was described as being friendly, fun, and very communicative. She liked meeting new people and made friends easily. In 2006, at the age of 22, she qualified as a realtor. She met a young man called Jason Zalo, and they started dating. Jason was the son of Shirley Zalo. Shirley owned a RE/MAX franchise, a real estate brokerage. This made it much easier for Lindsay to get her first brokerage job. In 2007, their relationship was going so well that they decided to move in together. In the last week of January 2008, when Lindsay was 24, she received a call from a potential client. The woman said her husband's employment was being relocated from Vancouver to Victoria. They had decided that it would be better to buy a house instead of renting, as his contract was for an indefinite period. The house needed to have 3 bedrooms, 3 bathrooms, at least 1 master suite, and their budget was around $1 million. The couple were currently in Vancouver, but they were travelling to Victoria that Saturday to start making arrangements, so if Lindsay had a house to view, they could perhaps close a deal that weekend. In 2008, $1 million could buy you a fine house in an upmarket neighbourhood in Victoria. So for Lindsay, these were VIP clients. They had a substantial budget and wanted to close quickly. After the call, Lindsay realised that she had forgotten to get her new client's name. This was unusual, but understandable. She was excited about the possibility of a big new contract. Anyway, it wasn't a problem, as she had the client's number registered on her cell phone. She wrote down the number in her diary and planned to ask her her name on the next call. Although Lindsay was excited, she was also somewhat apprehensive. This was a significant sales opportunity on a scale that she had never had before. In Canada, a broker usually earns an average of 7% commission, so signing this contract would earn her around $70,000. She talked to her father Jeff, a realtor in Calgary, Alberta, and her boyfriend Jason. They both encouraged her to pursue the sale. The worst that could happen was that it would not go through, but that was normal in her profession. Lindsay could not explain it, but she really felt that something was off. This sudden call from a new client seeking to buy a house in just 2 days. As Lindsay had not asked their names, and due to the woman's strong Spanish accent, she simply referred to them as the Mexicans. Lindsay found a house on her property list which met their demands. A large house in Sarnik, an upper-middle-class neighbourhood about 5 minutes from the city centre. She called the client back and they agreed to view the house on Saturday, February 2nd at 5:30 p.m. It is not clear who suggested this time, but it is believed that it must have been the client. In Canada, February is winter time and Lindsay would not have suggested a time when it would already be dark. According to the website sunrise-sunset.com, in Victoria, on February 2nd, the sun set at 5:12 p.m. No realtor would show a house when it is dark. You cannot view the garden properly or identify any damage to the property, so this time of day is a bit strange. But as I said, everything suggests that this choice was made by the client. On Saturday morning, she first visited the beauty salon. Then she and Jason went to lunch around 3 p.m. at a restaurant in downtown Victoria called Source, where a friend was a waitress. She told Jason and the waitress that she had some anxieties about the property viewing that afternoon, but they reassured her that it would be fine. Jason had arranged to meet a friend named Cohen Oatman at 5:30 p.m. to buy some hockey supplies. Lindsay went home, changed, and went to the property. The house had an electronic lock which recorded that she opened the property at 5:29 in the afternoon. At exactly 5:30, Jason sent a message to Lindsay saying, "Hey, I'm going to be a little late." At 5:33, she responded, "Right, see you soon. I need to go. The Mexicans are here." At 5:38, Jason sent another message, "Coming in a few minutes." Only this time, Lindsay didn't respond. Jason was not worried because he understood that she was probably still showing the house, being attentive to her clients, and so of course it was not unusual that she did not respond. Jason and Cohen pulled up in front of the house. At 5:45, he witnessed a man exiting the front door. When the man saw Jason, he quickly re-entered the house and closed the door behind him. Jason assumed that the visit was still ongoing and chose not to enter. Concerned that the clients would think they were also there to view the property, he and his friend parked the car a little further away on the corner of a dead-end street. They stayed there for about 15 minutes. At 6 p.m, there was still no movement in the house. The lights did not turn off, and so at 6:02 he sent a message. "Is everything okay there?" Again, there was no response. Jason and Cohen decided to approach the property. The front door was locked. Jason was worried. No one locks the front door from the inside during a house viewing. He rang the doorbell, knocked on the door, called her name, but no one responded. Looking through the window, they could see Lindsay's shoes. It was as if she had taken them off to avoid dirtying the floor of the house. But only her shoes were there, not the client's. Cohen decided to go around the house and try to gain entry through a side door. In the backyard, he noticed that the glass door accessing the kitchen was completely open. He entered and went to the front door to let Jason in. They started calling for Lindsay, but she did not respond. Jason went to the first floor. At the top of the stairs, he found Lindsay lying in front of the master suite bathroom, covered in blood. He quickly called the police. This call was made at 6:11 and asked them to send a police car and an ambulance immediately. Lindsay wasn't moving or breathing. Jason tried to resuscitate her, but it was too late. She was dead. The police and the ambulance arrived within minutes and found that Lindsay had been stabbed multiple times with a knife. There is an inconsistency in the sources of information here, as some reports say there were 10 wounds, others say 18, others say dozens, that is, more than 20, whatever the exact amount, and it is clear that it was a large amount. Nothing was stolen from Lindsay. Her wallet and cell phone were still there. The autopsy revealed that the official cause of death was blood loss due to multiple knife wounds. Lindsay was first attacked from behind, and she had made no attempt to defend herself. The first blow destabilized her, and the other blows were made while she was completely defenseless. It looked like a crime of passion, a murder fueled by rage. Jason and his friend Cohen were taken to the police station and questioned, but were soon released after images proved that they were not near the location at the time of the crime. Jason was identified at exactly 5:30 p.m. in a parking lot far from the scene. The police focused their investigation on the people closest to the couple, Despite the outward appearance of peace and tranquility, some witnesses reported that Lindsay and Jason's relationship was not so beautiful behind the curtains. In December 2007, Lindsay told her father Jeff that she was thinking about leaving Jason, because even though she knew he liked her a lot, he was very jealous. He was possessive at times and she was getting tired of it. To this day, no one knows whether Jason already knew about her intention to end their relationship or whether he only discovered it during the investigation. He cooperated with the police and even agreed to take and pass a polygraph test. The police found no evidence to incriminate him, but there were certain small details that made them suspicious all the same. Remember that Jason called the police as soon as he saw Lindsay lying on the floor of the house? Well, that wasn't his first call. While he was still outside knocking on the front door and Cohen was at the back of the house, he had called the police at 6:05 p.m. But this was not an emergency call. According to a transcripted summary of the call, he explained that he and his girlfriend were both realtors and that she was meeting a female client at a property. He had arrived with a friend to collect her. They were knocking at the door, but nobody was answering. He also said that through the front door window, they could see the shoes she had kicked off prior to walking through the house. The investigation found it a little strange that he had already called the police at that time, but he gave the excuse that he understood brokerage laws and that in Canada it is forbidden to break into a house, so for him to jump over a wall or try to break down a door would be committing a crime, and that's why he preferred to call the police immediately. But then, he did exactly the opposite several minutes later. With these facts, the police called Jason to the scene of the crime so that he could explain step by step what happened that day. The images of the reconstruction published on the internet only cover the moment he opened the door until the moment he climbed the stairs, and I will now present that same part to you.
Which side of the door was going on when the door opened for you?
Right where the door.
So, yeah. So he opens it like this. Does he open it all the way, or you just
he unlocked the door?
Okay, he unlocks it. Yeah. So I unlock it. Okay, it's unlocked.
I just opened it.
Okay. So.
So I don't know if his hand. I know that because I heard it unlock.
Okay.
The second he unlocked it, I pushed it open.
Okay.
He was already in front of me.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm running upstairs.
Okay.
And so I was yelling, I'm like, Lindsay.
And where did Cohen go?
He went straight ahead.
He went straight ahead?
Yeah.
Okay.
So
just hang on a sec there.
Yeah.
So he went straight ahead?
Yeah.
And you went running upstairs?
Yeah.
Okay, so let me go upstairs first, and then you can talk your way, go up the stairs, and then we'll go to the end, right?
Mm-hmm.
You okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I was running inside the house. I just came running up the stairs.
Do you remember grabbing the banister at all, or
down there?
Okay. What else were you doing? Did you see anything? Did you hear anything? Did you smell anything? Kind of put yourself back there into that exact moment.
The time I got to from the door to upstairs was probably 2 seconds.
Okay, so you're
like I was running up the stairs.
Okay.
Yeah, like I didn't walk, I didn't. The second I opened the door, I yelled, Lindsay. And then I ran up these stairs as fast as I could.
Okay.
Hey, você se interessa por crimes reais, serial killers, coisas macabras e tem um senso de humor um tanto quanto sórdido? Se sim, você não está sozinho.
Se você precisa de um lugar recheado de pessoas como você, venha conhecer o podcast Pátria Amada Criminal.
Todas as semanas tentamos entender o pior da humanidade.
Nesse processo a gente ri, chora, fica brava, fofoca, porque afinal de contas é assim que a gente fala quando está entre amigos.
Suas novas melhores amigas trevosas estão aqui no Pátria Amada Criminal.
People, in the meantime, were finding Jason's behavior very strange, Apparently, he was cold. When he talked about the case, he didn't get emotional. No one ever saw Jason cry, and he quickly returned to his work routine. But strange behavior in itself does not incriminate anyone, and the police did not have enough evidence to prove his guilt. They interviewed family, friends, co-workers, people Lindsay had met that day, including the waitress at the restaurant she dined at that afternoon, and there was nothing. Not a single clue. They hoped was to trace the call that Lindsay received from the client, but when the report came out, it was found that this phone was a prepaid device, a very basic model that didn't even have internet access. It had been purchased at a convenience store in Vancouver in November 2007, 3 months before the murder. It was registered in the name of Paulo Rodriguez without ID. And since the device was purchased with cash, the owner was untraceable. Detail: this phone was no longer used after the crime. When the leads seemed to be running out, a neighbour of the house Lindsay was showing went to a police station to give a voluntary statement. He was walking his dog at the time the realtor was greeting her clients at the door. He saw a good part of what happened outside before they entered. From his testimony, which lasted a few hours, a sketch was made and the pre-crime was reconstructed. This neighbour's report was very important because it was very rich in facts about what happened outside. The man had noticed that there was only one car in front of the garage, a black car that belonged to Lindsay, so he didn't know how the clients had travelled there. There were no more cars parked on the street. As the street was a dead end, he turned around and entered the next street, and there he saw right on the corner a white van. It was not common to see those vans there in a 100% residential neighbourhood on a Saturday night. Repair companies like electricity, plumbing for example, usually have the company name on the doors or on the side. But according to this neighbour, this van was a little old and didn't have any advertising. It was completely white. Regarding the physical profile of the suspects, they were a couple, a white man, about 1.85 meters tall, and wearing an elegant brown jacket that reached below the waist. The other was a woman, who must have been between 35 and 45 years old, blonde, with hair on her shoulders, and a dress that attracted a lot of attention. It was black, hot pink and white, and these colours were arranged in highly prominent vertical wavy lines. He practically drew on paper more or less what this dress looked like. The police even researched this piece because if it was made by a brand that didn't produce many, they could even use this as a clue to share with the public. But they discovered that the dress was from a brand that sold at Saks Fifth Avenue. It was produced in a very large series, and it would be like looking for a needle in a haystack using just this clue. The dress was so easy to find that in the reenactments of the pre-crime, the actress playing the woman wore that same dress. This reconstruction was created exclusively from the witness's point of view. What is not known is what exactly happened inside the house. This is the strangest part of this case because the forensics were unable to find anything. Absolutely nothing inside the house that could lead to the killers. Not a hair, not a fingerprint, not a footprint was found. Anything. Which meant that these killers entered, and in practically 12, 15 minutes they inflicted dozens of fatal blows on their victim and left without leaving a trace. It was unbelievable. The police were then certain that they were dealing with a case involving a professional killer, because only an experienced person who knows what they are doing could commit a crime like this without leaving absolutely anything behind. With no traces and no clues, the police then stopped focusing the investigation on the who and start focusing on the why. Suspicions returned to Jason, and also now to his mother, due to a sin that could be the connection of all this. The Financial Fraud Investigation Department had information that the franchise owned by Shirley, Jason's mother, was carrying out illegal transactions with and was engaged in money laundering. The police then began to theorize that Lindsay might have learned of information that she should not have known and had to be eliminated. Following this line of reasoning, they found many more strange things. The narcotics department shared with investigators a fact that made them think that perhaps there could be a connection. In the same week that this crime happened, the police station in Victoria was investigating a crime related to drug trafficking. But it was an on-site and undercover investigation, somewhat secret. Weeks before the crime, they were doing a sweep for some drug dealers. They raided a house and found cocaine valued at approximately $2.5 million. So the fact that the police broke this operation affected the pockets of many drug dealers. This investigation was related to the arrest in Calgary of a drug dealer named Erickson Del Alcazar, aged 22, on January 22nd. Calgary is the same city that Lindsay was in a month before this arrest, and the police analysed this drug dealer's call records. And what did they find? 3 missed calls from Lindsay's number. Her phone records also confirm the calls to him, and also show that she just called him without leaving a voicemail message on any of the calls. He didn't call back, and there were no text messages sent either. Even though these calls were strange, it was discovered that this drug dealer was a friend of Lindsay's from her school days and that she had not seen him for a long time. Despite Lindsay's close family and friends confirming that she did not use drugs and had no contact with drug dealers, police suspicions around Lindsay's death escalated from a file burning to a kind of revenge or debt payment. When more people from this gang were arrested after his death, more information came to light. The house that was raided with millions in drugs seized had been rented by a friend of Jason's, who he claims he barely knew, that he really only knew his brother. However, the house, rented by this friend or non-friend, was owned by Jason's mother. Yes, that's right. Regarding this, Shirley said that she owned several properties in Victoria. Her real estate agency also owned several commercial and residential properties, and she no longer even knew who her properties were rented to. That this has nothing to do with her son being his friend or his brother's, and her being the owner of the house. In the end, they finally managed to get his son out of the way. But there is a difference between being an owner and a broker. You may have several houses in your catalogue, but your houses, the ones that you own and receive almost all the rent money for, are highlighted in your income. That sounds strange. With all of this, the police investigated their real estate agency even more deeply, because they were on the list of companies reported for money laundering, and this money laundering could very well be linked to drug trafficking, but they found nothing. So up to that point, what we had was, Shirley had rented one of her personal houses to Jason's friend's brother, a drug dealer, and this place was frequented by several others, including one who was known to Lindsay. It is difficult to consider that these facts are just coincidences. Is there any way to ignore this information and let it pass by, to let the case go cold? But that's what happened. After this discovery, nothing more was done in the investigation, and the case was practically closed due to lack of evidence. Lindsay's father, Jeff Buziak, created a blog to share photos, information, and also to collect possible new evidence that could help bring justice for his daughter's murder. The website is lindsaybuziakmurder.com, and there is even a petition to have Lindsay's case taken away from the Sarnic police and passed on to a larger body in Canada, because he feels one of two things could be happening. The police are corrupt. Someone inside has no interest in taking this investigation forward, or else the police station is simply too small and no one is paying attention to this case because they have other cases to deal with. On this blog, on August 19th, 2017, an anonymous message was sent and said the following. I killed Lindsay and stupid cops will never prove it, so you all got nothing. Ask Jay-Z and Sandy Delcaxar. They know. Vid and Medardo are involved too. No one gives a shit anymore anyhow except her crybaby dad. Even her fakey girlfriends have washed it away. Typical loser chicks. Saanich cops dropped it because they can't solve any shit and were told to drop it. Chief Downey has been owned for years. He had to obey, so he cut the phony investigation. It's done. Go home, losers. Forget about her. The street always rules. Bitches die every day. Once again, the police were unable to find concrete information about this. They said they couldn't locate the origin of the message. This confirms one of Lindsay's father's two hypotheses. Jeff, to this day, for over 10 years, fights to try to discover those responsible with the support of family and friends. He takes an annual walk called Remembrance Walk, so that people will never forget the case. Jason is still apparently well. He is active on social media. His mother sold the real estate business and they opened a property financing company. They carry on with their lives as if nothing had happened, living their normal lives. They are not interested, active, or supportive in unraveling the mystery of this crime. Whether it was a crime of passion or not, a debt payment or not, a file burning or not, to this day, unfortunately, Lindsay Buziak's killers have never been identified.
Hey, você se interessa por crimes reais, serial killers, coisas macabras e tem um senso de humor um tanto quanto sórdido? Se sim, você não está sozinho.
Se você precisa de um lugar recheado de pessoas como você, venha conhecer o podcast Pátria Amada Criminal.
Todas as semanas tentamos entender o pior da humanidade.
Nesse processo a gente ri, chora, fica brava, fofoca, porque afinal de contas é assim que a gente fala quando está entre amigos.
Suas novas melhores amigas trevosas estão aqui, no Pátria Amada Criminal.